Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 194, Smorgasbord, September 2021. Everybody, thanks so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking. Getting in the kitchen, learning new things, growing our skills and our confidence, having fun. I'm so glad to be back with you. I know it's been a couple of weeks since I've been able to put anything out. This end of summer has just been a bit crazy, I've got to say. Just a lot of stuff going on, and it has not been easy to get into the recording booth and put one of these together. But here I am. And, you know, actually last week, you know, in August, I was trying to lean a little bit into the Caribbean flavors. I did record another live cooking episode. It didn't turn out all that great, so I chose not to release it. But I might redo it and put it out anyway. Haven't had a chance to get back in the kitchen to re-record it. I'll talk about that in a minute. But today I've got a smorgasbord episode, which means a few different topics. And actually, I'm focusing on questions I've gotten over the past couple of months. I've picked a few out, and I want to share them and answer them on the podcast. That's usually a lot of fun. And it brings up some interesting things that I think other people might be interested in hearing when people ask questions. So I've got a handful of cooking questions we're going to go through today. Also, at the end of the episode, I will have another cookbook giveaway. It's been a while since I've done one of those. But I've got a fantastic cookbook, The Food of Oaxaca by Alejandro Ruiz, and we're going to be giving that one away today. So stick around. Later in the show, I'll be telling you all about how to do that. Put your name into the hat, and if I pick your name out, I will mail that cookbook to you. So no strings attached. Always fun. All right, so first of all, the show notes for this episode, kitchencounterpodcast.com/194. If you want anything, links to anything I mention in this episode, head over there. You'll find it. Also, the Kitchen Counter Podcast is a proud member of Nitty Grits Podcasts out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. You know, as I record this, we're about a week past Hurricane Ida. I think a week, maybe a day or two longer, which, as you probably No, hit the southeast and actually the northeast. The whole path of Ida was kind of a mess, right? So it hit those places hard. And I know there's terrible things happening everywhere, and there's always people that can use a hand. But I just want to put out a special note that, you know, if you can help, I will put some links in the show notes to some places that are working locally, at least in the southeast. I'll try to find some stuff for the northeast as well. But, you know, our friends over at World Central Kitchen are in the southeast handing out meals to families and first responders and cleanup crews, to make sure that they're fed. Of course, places like the American Red Cross are doing important work, and, you know, countless other organizations that are doing work to help that obviously I can't take the time to name on the show. But head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/194, and I'll put a few links there for places you can help. If you want to find out more, by the way, about the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, which got through Hurricane Ida unscathed, thankfully, you can head over to southernfood.org. All right, let's jump into the smorgasbord episode for September 2021. Oh, hey, you know, I forgot to mention that if you want to send me an email, if you have a question you just want me to answer on email or bring up on a future podcast episode, or just want to say hi, send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And a bunch of info on Facebook and other places, Twitter, that you can find me in our community if you head over to the show notes. Okay, so I mentioned a minute ago, last week I attempted to make my final Caribbean-inspired dish for the month of August. I actually tried to make mofongo, which is a plantain dish, mostly popular, I think, in Puerto Rico, but I think you can find it in other places, in other forms throughout the Caribbean. And actually, it's got some roots in Africa as well. But it's a mash. It's a fried plantain dish where the plantains are fried, then mashed together with garlic, sometimes with pork cracklings or other ingredients. But it's something that is very easy to make, typically, unless you botch it somehow like I did, while you're recording it, of course. But it's typically easy to make. It's quite delicious, and it uses plantains, which I think cooks in North America don't appreciate as much, obviously, as folks in Central and South America, the Caribbean, where they use plantains on the regular. So I'll get my brain wrapped around the mofongo for a future episode, but I wanted to talk a little bit about plantains today because if you're not familiar with them, you may have heard of them, but you may not understand what they are, how they differ from their close cousin, the banana. They look very similar if you've seen them both in the store. They look similar, but they're obviously different, right? So let's start there and talk about that for our first. It's not really a question, but it's my first topic for today's smorgasbord, the difference between bananas and plantains and how you use plantains as a cook. And you know what's funny? I had all these notes typed up that I was going to use to talk about this, but I can't find them anywhere. So my computer ate them, apparently. But anyway, we'll keep it simple here. So bananas and plantains, when you see them side by side, it's very easy to see that they're related somehow. But the bananas that you and I find in the grocery store all over North America, that, you know, typical ripe yellow banana is the variety of that particular banana, by the way, is the Cavendish banana, is quite sweet. It's not starchy really at all. And when they're ripe, your typical Cavendish banana is something around the neighborhood of 30% sugar. So it's quite sweet. And it's got that distinctive banana flavor. I mean, you know what banana tastes like. You've tasted it not only in bananas, but other, candies and things like that. So you know what a banana tastes like. A plantain, on the other hand, is much starchier and much less sugary, much less sweet than a banana. You know, you can take a banana, you can peel it, you can eat it straight away, and you're good to go. You cannot do that with a plantain. You have to cook plantains before you can eat them. And what's interesting about plantains as opposed to bananas, you know, bananas, you typically want them to get nice, evenly yellow and ripe before you eat them. You know, you typically don't eat green bananas, and most people don't like bananas once the skin starts to turn dark and spotted and blotchy. Those are usually too far gone for most people, and it maybe in best case scenario, those bananas are destined for something like a banana bread. Well, with a plantain, you can actually use a plantain in all degrees of ripeness, depending on what you want to make. So you can actually use very green, unripe plantain. So when you go to the store and you see a green plantain, that's just an unripe plantain, and it's very starchy, is much closer to something like a raw potato or a yam or a cassava than it is to a sweet banana, even an unripe banana. It's much more used like a starch. And as you let a plantain ripen, turn yellow, all the way to where the skin is almost completely black or very, very splotchy, right? Again, if you compare that to a banana, no one would even want to touch that. It would be nearly rotten. But when a plantain gets to that point, it's actually much sweeter than you would expect. It doesn't really taste like a banana, but it's about as sweet as it's going to be. And then you can use a plantain at that stage of ripeness too for sweeter recipes. But if we go back to the unripe plantain, which is what you would use in a mofongo, or something like tostones, which are sliced and fried and salted plantain pieces or chips, savory dish, they almost act like a fried potato or something to that effect. So if you see a plantain in the grocery store next to the bananas, know they're quite different. You have to cook a plantain in order to eat them. You can't eat them raw, but they can be a very nutritious starch on your dinner plate. And there are a lot of ways to cook a plantain. I'm going to include a bunch of links in the show notes so you can see some of those ways to deal with a plantain. But I thought because I'm sort of in the mofongo thing right now, I would just talk for a minute about plantains and bananas to give you a super high level overview of the general difference when it comes to cooking and eating plantains and bananas. You know, plantains are not something you would accidentally buy and know what to do with, I don't think, because, again, you do have to cook them before you can use them. But a huge staple in Caribbean, Central, and South American cuisine, used all the time. I have eaten, when I've traveled in Central America or the Caribbean, I have eaten my fair share of at least fried plantains as a side to many dishes, and they are delicious. And really easy to pull off at home. So head over to the show notes. I'll share some recipes for those if you're interested. Now, let's get into some questions. Now, the first question I have, I took from a few different people because I've seen it asked several ways in different places, including emails to me. And it is, I guess, somewhat timely. So the general question that I'm seeing, and I've actually gotten this in past years, and I've never done an episode on it, though I probably could devote an entire episode to it, but folks are looking for cooking tips for college students who are either enrolling in college for the first time, going away to college, going back to school this time of year, some cooking tips for those folks. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty big topic. It could take up a whole series of podcast episodes in and of itself, depending on, is the student living in the dorms or somewhere else on campus? Do they have their own apartment? What are they allowed to use? Do they have access to a kitchen or, a stove at least? So there's a lot of different questions. So rather than go too broad, I'm gonna offer a general bit of advice when it comes to cooking for college kids, and it focuses on equipment, because college kids don't have a lot of room or money to buy cooking utensils and pots and pans. They may not have a wide variety of appliances at their disposal. In fact, I just went over to the Oregon State University website here just to see, what can kids take to the dorm? They can take virtually nothing that's an appliance. I don't think rice cookers are allowed. I don't think you can't bring a microwave unless it's somehow part of your in-unit fridge or something like that. You can't take a toaster oven. None of those things are allowed. You can't take a hot plate. None of those are allowed in the dorm room. But they do have access, I believe, to common kitchens in the dorms. So if I were a college student and I needed to be minimalist on what I could take to college to cook with, in terms of costs and how much space I have, but also maximize the variety of things I could cook, if I could only take one piece of equipment with me, I'm not talking about knives and spatulas and stirring spoons and all that, but like cooking vessels, I would probably take a skillet and a lid. We'll call that technically one piece, but like a high-sided skillet, a skillet that's probably 10 inches and maybe has, 10 inches in diameter, and then the sides are probably 2 or 2.5 inches tall with a nice lid. I think you can cook a dizzying array of recipes with just that piece of equipment, assuming you have access to a stovetop, a range where you could cook on. If you go with stainless steel, you could also use that to cook in the oven as well. Of course, you could do that with things like cast iron as well, but stainless steel is pretty durable and versatile. In my opinion, probably the most versatile if you're looking for something like this. But look, in a tall-sided skillet with a lid, you can fry, you can saute, You could put some water in there and cook pasta. You could, if you can put it in the oven, you could even make like skillet bread. There's a lot of things you can make with just a tall-sided skillet and a lid, really. And for a college kid, that's probably, would cover 85% of your cooking needs, depending on how much you're cooking in the dorm kitchen or whatever, or your small apartment. But that would be my number one recommendation. If you had room for a second item, I'd say maybe like a rimmed baking sheet. That's pretty versatile. So you can roast vegetables or make, sheet pan type dinners and things like that. Or just reheat things or, heat up frozen French fries, whatever, in the oven. That might be a nice second item. But, between those two things, you can do a lot. And the other side of that too is if you're a, you know, a college age student and you love to cook and you don't have a lot of cooking equipment or places to cook, I mean, you will learn to adapt and you'll probably really grow your cooking skills because you'll have to learn to do things a little bit differently. You won't have, you know, at your fingertips 10 different pots and pans or, you know, 8 different ways. You're not going to have a sous vide and a toaster oven and a stovetop and a range and, you know, or a convection oven or an air fryer. You're not going to have all of these things. So you're going to learn how to cook, actually, and it'll be awesome. And of course, you should have, you know, I wouldn't probably spend money on a real great knife if you're taking it to college because it'll probably just get ruined. But, you know, a serviceable knife and, you know, some wooden utensils and a spatula or something like that, and you'll be in good shape. So that's what I would say for college kids going back and wanting to do cooking on their own. If their space and resources are limited, a skillet with a lid and then maybe a baking sheet. So that's what I'll say for now. I'm curious to know if you have college age kids going back to school and if they're cooking, what are they doing? Send me an email. I'd love to hear about it. I'm curious. I'm not quite there yet. My son's only 9, so I've got a ways to go. But and by the time he's in college, things may change drastically. Who knows? But I'd be curious to hear. When I was in college, I lived in apartments pretty much the whole time. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I didn't have very good stuff and I didn't have much. But in an apartment, you can at least be fairly confident you'd have access to a stove top and an oven. But yeah. All right, let's see here. Let's move on. So Darren from Denver, he sent me a couple emails with a couple of different questions. I just grabbed a couple of them just to highlight here. And I guess they're kind of related now that I look at them. And the first one, Darren wanted to just simply understand the difference between a broth and a stock. And I can't remember if I've done an episode on this or not, but the rule of thumb here with broths and stocks, they're obviously both liquids. Think of a broth as more of a finished food item, something that you might just consume by itself. For example, much more seasoned and flavored. And then a stock is something is more of a component that you would use in recipes. Typically, a stock would be made maybe with, if it's an animal product, like a chicken or a beef stock, or even a fish or a shrimp stock, it would be made with bone in the case of everything but the shrimp, in which case it would be shell. So you have that extra collagen usually in the stock that makes it great for as a base for sauces. But stocks are typically much less strongly flavored. They don't usually have a lot of herbs and spices and seasonings in them. So as far as interchangeability, to a degree, yes, you can interchange them in recipes insofar as the recipe is calling for some sort of a liquid like a chicken broth or chicken stock. Again, just remember that the broth may be much more strongly flavored and it could impact how your recipe tastes if your recipe is calling for a chicken stock. So just, you know, taste it first. Make sure you understand what you're working with before you just interchange them, blindly. And then he had another question. I thought this was interesting. I'd never really thought about this, but I know freezing food is of interest to a lot of folks. And he asks, when it comes time, I don't have his question right in front of me, but I just wrote down, when it comes time to freezing soup, do I tend to use, you know, the slightly more finicky port in a Ziploc bag method and then freezing it, or just going with your basic Tupperware with a lid and freezing it that way. The idea, I think, being that maybe Ziploc is more airtight and Tupperware may be less airtight. I think it depends on the type of soup or the liquid that I'm freezing. So generally, I think when I'm freezing a soup that is a little bit thicker, like a cream-based soup perhaps, or something more like a stew, I typically do go with Ziploc freezer bags. What you can do is you try to find a Ziploc, a Tupperware or some other bowl that you can do kind of like the garbage bag approach where you put the Ziploc in and kind of fold the sides over carefully. It helps you pour in easier. But regardless, pour it in the Ziploc bags, seal it up, squeeze as much air out as you can, and then you can lay those flat and put them in the freezer, and they freeze nice and flat like little bricks. They take up a lot less room. But if I'm working with a more liquidy, like a more broth based, or if I'm freezing homemade stock or something like that, I almost, in that case, always go with some sort of a firm container, like a Tupperware. But I like the kind with the screw on lids. You can find them. They're like quart size, or they come in different sizes, but they're cylinders. They have screw on lids. Those work great for liquid soups, or if you're freezing your own stocks or things like that. So I'm probably not 100% firm on those different use cases, but typically that's what it is. I'll use the Ziploc for the heavier, thicker stuff, and Tupperware for the thinner stuff, just because I think it's a little easier to work with. I really, really do love, though, in the grocery store, you can find, it's not Tupperware and it's not disposable, but it's like the multi-use, like Glad, I think, makes the little resealable freezer containers or lunch containers and things like that. I'll try to find a link for it if they have them online, but there is a brand that does make pretty solid screw top containers that you can use, you know, indefinitely multiple times. And those are just really great for liquids. Okay, let's see what else we have here. Sarah from Tacoma, Washington. Sarah was wondering what my opinion was on the herbs that come in the tubes in the refrigerator section in the produce department. Do I use them? Do you think they work well as fresh version of the herbs? So yes, Sarah, good question. So these are, they look like, what do they look like? What do the tubes look like? Almost like hand lotion tubes or something like that. That's a gross thought to think that your herbs are in hand lotion tubes, but that's what they look like. And you can get things like garlic puree or basil, or I think pretty much any herb you can think of, you can find in these tubes that you find in the refrigerator section. You have to leave them refrigerated once you buy them and bring them home. They last for several weeks, and it's basically you can squeeze out a dollop of whatever it is in the tube when you need it. So yes, I have used those before. I don't use them very often. And there's a couple, I'm not saying they're bad, but there's a couple of things you need to be aware of when you're using those. One is it's typically not purely just that herb. So if you, I don't know, pick up the garlic paste one or whatever, and you look at the ingredients, I mean, garlic will probably be the number one ingredient, but there's probably also other things like preservatives, perhaps other seasonings in there. That won't be exactly what you'd get if you just used fresh, regular garlic and, you know, processed it in a food processor yourself or something like that. The other thing that, this is an obvious thing, and you probably already have realized this, Sarah, but they're like in paste form or puree form already. So it's not like you can use these in place of, it's not like you can use a tube of parsley or something as a garnish if you just want to sprinkle some chopped parsley on, right? Obviously. So they're different in that way too. Their use is a little less versatile as a fresh herb. So they're really more like a stir-in sort of a thing. If you're making a sauce or something and you want to add a little bit of this herb flavor in it, you can use these. If it's something you're interested in, like having herbs all the time, there's certainly a convenience factor to these, right? That's probably what makes them the most appealing. They're probably a little more expensive than going and buying just the fresh herbs. But, you know, you can preserve your own herbs as well by, for example, pureeing them with some olive oil and then freezing them in ice cube containers, right? Now you have these little bricks, little blocks of olive oil and whatever herbs you've pureed in with it that are in the freezer that you can toss in your soups or your sauces or your stews or whatever anytime you want. So there's other ways you could get to this sort of on-hand, never goes bad herb mix-in thing. If that's what you're looking for, you might just be curious about these things and not, I'm probably reading too much into what you're asking, but there are other ways that you could, you know, have these flavorful herb concoctions on hand that you can use much in the same way that you can use these tubes of herbs, and probably with fewer extra ingredients. By the way, you can freeze herbs in water too. It doesn't have to be olive oil, but depending on what you're going to be using them for, there's some options. I found a good link for freezing fresh herbs. I'll put those in the show notes for you, Sarah. You can check that out. Okay, let's see. Colleen, I don't know where Colleen's from, but Colleen wrote that, there was a long message, but the question here. With my kids back in school and me now working in the office again most days of the week, I would love some ideas on how to make super easy meals taste better with minimal effort. For example, my kids love spaghetti using store-brand pasta sauce in the jar. It's okay, but how would you improve the flavor without spending a lot of time? You know what, Colleen? I didn't realize this when I was jotting these down in my notes, but you know, the whole question from Sarah about the herbs, that would be one way to do it, I think. Fresh herbs or frozen preserved herbs mixed into these things, these pre-made meals like store-brand pasta sauces. I'm trying to think what else. The pasta sauce is an easy example. Now that's all I can think of. But, you know, anything, any of these pre-made meals that are somewhat complete that come in jars or are frozen and there's like some sauce component to them. A lot of those are perfectly fine, but I understand what you're saying. You want to make them taste maybe a little more homemade or a little fresher or something like that, but you're using these because you don't have tons of spare time to cook things from scratch. So I get that. So you're looking for ways to just improve the flavor a little bit. I'll tell you, one of my favorite things to do is use something, I guess, like a sofrito method, if you think of it this way. And a sofrito is where you take different vegetables, usually aromatic vegetables, herbs, you process them very finely, either by using a knife to chop them up very finely or using a food processor or a blender. And you can use these as a flavor base, not only if you're making things from scratch, but I think you can probably use these pretty successfully if you're using pre-made sauces and stuff like that. So for example, with a store-brand pasta sauce, one of my favorite bases for like a tomato-based sauce, if I was making one, is to make like a sort of like a mirepoix sofrito crossover. So a mirepoix would be onion, carrot, and celery. Because you're only going to spend a few minutes with them, you're not going to spend a long time cooking them down, I would just chop them roughly, big chunks, throw them in a food processor, process them until they're kind of a rough paste. And then I would probably put my saucepan on the stovetop, heat it up with a little olive oil, and then toss in that mixture you just made. Maybe with a pinch of salt, although your canned or your jarred sauce will probably have a lot of salt in it already, but so you could omit that. But I would want to cook that, stir that until the liquid cooks out, probably 5 or 6 minutes, and it starts to take on a little bit of color and cooks down. And because it's processed, the onions and the carrots and the celery are processed so finely, they'll cook quickly, they'll soften up quickly. And then after, you know, 5 or 6 minutes of that, you could add your store-bought sauce to the saucepan, cook it in, and maybe simmer it for 10 minutes or 15 minutes together. That would probably add. And then actually, if you have maybe some fresh basil or parsley, you could chop a little bit of that up and garnish it or throw it in right at the end. That would help make it taste a little fresher, I think. So that's one idea that I would do. And actually, you know, that mixture I just mentioned, you could make a big batch of that and freeze it. Much in the same way we were just talking about freezing herbs in an ice cube tray, you could do that with those vegetables and a little bit of water so it holds together, and then you would have that, or olive oil probably, and you would have those at the ready then whenever you wanted to. You could just pop one in on the stovetop and cook it down a little bit before you add whatever it is you're going to be heating up that you've bought. But I think the secret is really using a few really fresh ingredients just to kind of up not only the nutrition, I guess, of the sauce or whatever in this particular case, but just the flavor profile. I think that's the way to do it if you only have a few minutes to spend. I mean, obviously, if you had hours to spend, you'd probably make your own sauce. And I get that you don't. Not many of us do. So give that a try and let me know what you think. All right. Those were a few questions I wanted to tackle today. I want to talk about this book that I'm going to be giving away. By Alejandro Ruiz, The Food of Oaxaca. And Oaxaca is a town in I don't know how you would term it, South Central Mexico. If you look at the map of Mexico, and it's kind of right at the bottom of the curve before it kicks up. It's the Isthmus of Mexico. The Isthmus of Mexico, I can't say that. Isthmus of Mexico, right before it kicks up into the Yucatan Peninsula. And, you know, Oaxaca actually holds a very dear place in my heart because it was, to my knowledge, pretty sure the first place I traveled by myself out of the country. So for me, it was one of my really first big cultural experiences on my own. Now, I did meet a friend who was down there taking Spanish language classes. I landed in Mexico City, took a bus to Oaxaca, which is quite a bus ride. And actually, my friend and I spent a couple of weeks traveling around Mexico via bus. Oaxaca was where he was staying, and that's where I met him. And the food of Oaxaca is phenomenal. I have very fond memories. Well, actually, I think when Jairo was on the show, we talked about empanadas. I talked about Oaxacan empanadas on there. I just remember going to the market, and this was, again, my first sort of international open air market experience. And it was quite mind blowing. It really did change my way of thinking on just the world of food and ingredients. This was not a grocery store, right? This was an open air market. And the variety was mind blowing. And just buying the fresh bread and cheeses, the empanadas, there was something down in Oaxaca at the time too. And I don't know if this is a Oaxacan thing or if it was just something I stumbled upon, but they had the best marmalade in Oaxaca. And, you know, marmalade usually has a lot of like the bits and chunks in it. I really don't like it generally, but not the stuff in Oaxaca. It was very good. I want to read just something out of the introduction to this from Ruiz, because this will give you an idea of what you can expect in this cookbook. Oaxacan food is one of Mexico's most revered cuisines. Oaxaca is the birthplace of corn and is home to 50 to 60 different species that are transformed and cooked into a myriad of forms. Made up of 11 regions, each featuring distinct cultural and linguistic traits, Oaxaca enjoys some of the most exceptional biodiversity in Mexico, as becomes clear when visiting the main market or Mercado de Abastos, which spans more than 30 acres and offers an infinite array of goods from produce to food stalls, cookware, and crafts. Oaxaca's dishes, with their foundation of corn, chocolate, chiles, spices, reflect the marriage of its indigenous roots and technique with the imprint of Spanish influence. Really, really a great cookbook. It's as much recipes as it is a culinary history and tour, an expedition through Oaxaca. So if you're interested in the foods of Mexico, particularly of Oaxaca, you're going to want to get your hands on this book, and you can get it for free if you win the giveaway. And I'm looking right now. This is over 200 pages. It's a hardback cookbook, tons of recipes and incredible images, everything from tortillas to tamales, to mole. It's got it all in here. So this would be a foundational book in your bookshelf of cookbooks if this is the type of cuisine you're interested in. So how do you win a copy of The Food of Oaxaca, you ask? Simple. Head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway, and you will see this book there on that page with instructions how to win it. And right now I'm keeping my giveaways extremely simple. All you have to do to enter is provide your name and your email address, and that will enter you in the drawing to win this book. Now, make sure you follow through the directions that you'll see. Click the button and follow through the directions to ensure that you're entered. Right now, this is only open for folks in the United States and Canada, because I am actually, me, myself, shipping the book, mailing the book to whoever wins. So right now I'm limiting to those areas. I've been trying to find an alternative for folks that live outside of North America, because I do have listeners all over the place who I know, because they've emailed me, who I know would love to enter the cookbook drawings. But so for now, sorry, this is how we have to roll. But head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/giveaway, enter your email address to get into the drawing. I will not use that email address for anything other than contacting you if you win, I promise. And I am going to keep this particular contest open until the end of the month. So you have until September 30th, the end of the day, midnight, Pacific time, September 30th, to enter for the Food of Oaxaca cookbook by Alejandro Ruiz. So you want to get a hold of this, I promise. I will also put a link to it in the show notes if you just want to go over to Amazon, check it out, buy it, whatever. All right. I don't know about you, but it is September now. I love summer. I love spring in Oregon in summer. But fall, you know me, it's where it's at. And I'm very excited to start cooking some fall type dishes in the kitchen. This is the season I live for. So I hope you enjoy fall as well, because there's going to be some good fall-related yumminess coming up. Remember to go check out the Nitty Grits Podcast Network over at southernfood.org. To get to the show notes for this episode, kitchencounterpodcast.com/194. Thank you for taking the time to listen into the Smorgasbord episode today. Send me more questions. I would love to cover them on a future episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. All right, everybody, that will do it for this week. Until next time, I am Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.